What do you think of when I say the word marketplace? Facebook marketplace? Who was checking it this morning? Outdoor farmers markets? There is the marketplace of ideas found in podcasts, like the CBC podcast by that name, Ideas. Virtual marketplaces of ideas are easy to access, and they're usually free. We can shop around for ideas that affirm our beliefs, or browse for ideas that no one else seems to have. YouTube is just such a marketplace, as well as Facebook. This kind of shopping doesn't have a place for people to truly meet and pass goods and ideas from person to person. We cannot say that any of the markets of our day and age resemble anything close to the marketplaces of our ancient Greek ancestors. I know of no such places in our Western world today which brings together philosophical discourse, extreme spirituality or religious practices, and shopping for eggs, cinnamon buns, and kale. Not much of a combination around here. We have lost touch with the wonder of physical places that provide the kind of socializing that feeds our deepest needs, both spiritually and physically. We have lost touch with the goodness in religious practices that provide the kind of thing that we need to help us understand ourselves in this world, giving us a sense of meaning and purpose and hope. There is good reason to walk away from religion that has not done this well, that is, to give us a sense of meaning and hope. This is why people today say they are not religious, but they are spiritual. But this doesn't mean we should give up on religion and trust that we can then know on our own, walking through the woods, what the spiritual life is and how or even who we are meant to live this with and for. The vast knowledge and lived experience of the holy marketplace of our Christian tradition may not be able to compete with the think tanks and virtual marketplaces of our world today, but we need to push back at it nonetheless, just as Paul did in Athens in Acts 17. In the marketplace of the ancient capital of Greece, people have come to buy and sell commodities that include ideas and philosophy. Athens is the religious epicenter at the time for paganism in the first century. Paul is there observing it all as he waits for his friends Timothy and Silas to join him there. And whenever he steps out of the Jewish synagogue after a day of teaching and fellowshipping there, he is bombarded with the sights and sounds of pagan idolatry. Every street corner, storefront, garden park, alleyway, household, and plaza has altars set before statues of gold or stone or silver. Everywhere he walks, people are clad for worship, bringing sacrifices to place before one god or another represented in these statues. They go up and down the hills of the city, sweating with the labor of it all, anxious to seek the goodwill of the least of the gods to the greatest. Knowing that these gods war against each other, they spread their offerings around to any who will not be fighting and attend to their needs. Athens was the place to do all this. Greeks congregated there of all the places they could congregate to keep up the latest trends in pagan worship and ideas. Paul walks through a buzz of philosophical conversation that flies about like bees around a hive up and down the streets surrounding Mars Hill. He is not unfamiliar with this kind of buzz as a Jewish scholar and is willing to courageously enter into the fray of this great intellectual capital of the ancient world. So he argues with some of them in the marketplace, where this is the common place to do so, of course. And here he meets Epicurean and Stoic philosophers who hear something quite new from him. And as you would expect, a new idea among widely held philosophies brings suspicion to some and curiosity to others. Hearing that he is preaching of foreign deities, they ask Paul to speak to the Areopagus. This is the highest court in the city, set on a rock from which one could look down on the famous marketplace and across to the still more famous Acropolis with its spectacular temples. Luke, the author of Acts, sums up what would likely have taken Paul several hours to explain to this court. The first thing we hear Paul saying is, "I see how extremely spiritual you are in every way. For as I went through the city and looked carefully at the objects of your worship, I found among them an altar with the inscription to an unknown God. This God whom you worship without knowing is the one I'm telling you about." The last thing that Luke sums up from Paul's day on Mars Hill is basically that this God you do not know but worship in ignorance is the living God. For the man the Creator appointed to judge and save all beings rose from the dead. Paul is telling them that the time of their ignorance is over, and it's because it's come, the knowledge has come, they can know this God. They don't need to blunder about seeking some presence of a divinity that they cannot really know and seek to know. But here in his message, he's saying, you can know him. The Lord of heaven and earth, and of all things made by human hands, is alive in this man whom Paul speaks of without naming, but he has used the name and spoken of Jesus before. This God of whom people are all offsprings, as one of their famous philosophers said, is not contained, built, static, impersonal, cold and hard, and kind of above all things, needy. He doesn't need anything. Temples and altars, idols, and the plethora of gods needing to be placated and adored are not able to move them forward in life and personally care for them as they suppose. Instead, and this is new, the God of all gods offered himself to meet their needs and bring them life and breath this day and all the days going forward without all this buzz of pagan activity. N.T. Wright, a Pauline theologian, tells us that the Epicureans held a theory according to which the world and the gods were a long way away from one another, with little or no communication. And the result was that one should get on with life as best one could, discovering how to gain maximum pleasure from a quiet, sedate existence. Sound familiar? And then there's the Stoics, on the other hand. They believed that divinity lay within the present world and within each human being, so that this divine force, though hardly personal, could be discovered and harnessed. Good human living then, or virtue, consisted in getting in touch with and living according to this inner divine rationality. Now, the ideal life for the first group was to live independently, untroubled, unworried about larger questions, including one's own destiny. They saw no need to religiously worship at these man-made idols then. So they were like shaking their head at Paul. Yeah. But Paul pushed back at this argument, saying that God is not far from any of us and longs for a relationship of love with all his creatures. The second group of intellectuals were delighted to hear Paul tell them a divine life is in all human beings. But Paul pushed back at the limitations of their belief as well, to tell them something they hadn't considered before, which is that they are made in God's image, different from God, but given the opportunity to walk with the living God in this life and the next. Paul is telling them that the faithless, nameless, mythless altar with an inscription to the unknown God has a face, a name, a story that goes back to the creation of all things. Of all things that move and live and have their being. And he has made himself known through the resurrection from the dead of this man, Jesus. This was a radical philosophy for these intellectuals who had not really faced their agnosticism before. A true agnostic, you see, would be one who is agnostic about what they don't know, which means being open to know that they don't know what they are struggling through life to know. Could God exist and be the one above us and in all things, consecrating us, our lives and our places, so that we might buzz with conversation and activity that reflects this truth? Paul answered their question, verse 19. Are we able to know this teaching with a resounding yes? Here in this summary of his teaching to the pagan philosophers, he invites them to consider doing what he himself has done, which is to recognize that their extreme spiritual practices, their very religious ways, have been the bedrock from which God has risen to consecrate them and the world through the living God, the resurrected Jesus. We have no such marketplaces in our day where we can gather to talk about our existence with or without God. Religion has been under suspicion for a long time. There are no altars, of course, to various Greek gods on our street corners. No one is sweating it out, bringing offerings to idols of gold up to the hills of our peninsula, or gathering in the parks or plazas, openly debating whether God exists or not. Rather, the words that buzz about are, I am not religious, but I am spiritual. I think we need to push back at this phrase in much the same manner as Paul does. Religion is the bedrock for spirituality. Religion is practiced in a community that desires a good life, a holy life, in some way or other reflecting and honoring and learning from a living divinity that desires what we desire and yet cannot obtain otherwise. Spirituality is but one aspect of the religious life, as is the spirit one aspect of our physical and material existence as human beings. Being spiritual or being religious, they both require work and devotion. But the work that leads to a happy, fulfilled spiritual existence comes from the one who consecrates us in a community that worships the living God in real space and time. We are just this community. We are a holy people, consecrated by the living God, who meets all our needs for a spiritual existence in this life and the next. Our place is consecrated as well. This church building, the cemetery, and our grounds. Altogether, we are the temple of the living God, worshiping in holy spaces and places and making them so by our prayers, by our presence, by our unity. We are a marketplace where new thoughts about God and our existence in this world are to be fostered, to be heard and exchanged in this time and in this period of the history of the earth. And in all of this, we are meant to welcome and invite others into our marketplace. I have had a vision that has been growing ever since I came here to Holy Trinity, which is to see that all that we have and all that we steward is a place where people can come to experience the holiness of God. And so we have several projects underway that I feel maybe some of you know about, but it's good for you to know here and now. It fits with what I'm saying. We have been working towards creating a social corridor that links the flight path to the labyrinth, to the cemetery, to our garden park, you could say, to our church, to our hall. And with the good wood that we have collected from redoing the fence, we will put up signs saying, come on in, welcome here. And we will continue to create events, of course, for prayer and for gathering people together in ways that fosters beauty and goodness and truth. One other project that we have underway, it's all nearly done as a chapel, is creating a small sacred space over here. And after the service, I invite you to take a look. But this is something I think that is specific to us as Holy Trinity, out here on the ocean at the corner of Mills and West Saanich Road. We can offer something to this area that is not being offered otherwise. This is our calling, I think. I think that's why I'm here. May we all have the courage and the desire to not only in this place and as this community, to be people who go and invite others into this holy presence of God, who of course is not made of stone or silver or gold, but who has risen from the dead, who walks with us, the living God, consecrating places and spaces where we go, where we inhabit and seek the presence of God. Amen. Amen.